გასვი მებოჯი კეთხელი გაინტერესებს რა ხდება აქ არაფერი აქ ისევ ძველებურად დომინირებს ნაცრისფერი უმოძრაობისაგან ყველაფერს დაედო მტვერი ქალაქ ძინავს ვინ მემოჯი კეთხელი გაინტერესებს რა ხდება აქ არაფერი აქ ისევ ძველებურად დომინირებს ნაცრისფერი უმოძრაობისაგან ყველაფერს დაედო მტვერი შებეცი მასას, რომელიც სადარბაზო საფსამს და მეორე დღეს სამშობლოს სადღეგრძელო საცვამს შებეცი პოლიციელს, როცა არაფერი დამიშავებია და მაინც მომიქციეს შებეცი ქალაქის მერს, რომელიც იძლევა ბძანებებს და ჯერაც არ გამჩდარა თავის კაბინეტს შებეცი მამას, რომელიც თავის შვილს მეცამეტე დაბადების დღეზე ჩუქნის დანას შებეცი ვაჟკაც, რომელიც 24 შვიდზე ბირჟაზე ზის და გამლელებს თვალებს
Ia Uradze, welcome to Reimagining Soviet Georgia. Thank you for joining us today. Why don't you introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do?
Thank you for inviting me to talk about my book in your podcast. I'm a political economist and I'm doing research on finance and as well as states in the post-socialist space. This has been my research focus for some years by now. And right now I'm working also on a new research project, which is about cryptocurrency mining in Georgia. But basically, political economy of finance and kind of the historical evolution of financial sectors along the process of state building in post-socialism, that's my research.
I would like to ask, what is dollarization of Georgia? What is dollarization in general?
Dollarization is a pretty widely spread phenomena all over the world, and it has a long history, and it has been especially common in global South countries, in Latin American countries, in different African countries, but also in the post-socialist space. And a very wide definition of dollarization is that it refers to a process when countries usually do have their own national currencies, but a foreign currency, which is usually a US dollar, but it can also be a euro, or it has also sometimes been Swiss franc, when a foreign currency takes over the functions of the national currency. So what can the functions of the national currency be? So this could be that what currency people use for savings, for deposits, in what currency they take loans, not only households, but also firms and companies and governments themselves. And so these are the two most important dimensions of dollarization. So one is the deposit dollarization, and the other one is the loan dollarization. And this is then accordingly measured. So you have the total volume deposits, let's say, and then one would measure what is the share of foreign currency deposits in that, or what is the share of foreign currency loans in total loans. And then there is the third dimension, which is also very important, but it's very tricky to measure, and this is the price dollarization, and we have a lot of examples of that in Georgia. So this refers to setting prices in dollars, and a very prominent example of price dollarization in Georgia is, for example, the real estate market. So if somebody wants to buy a property or even rent a property, then the prices are usually said in US dollars, even until now. So yeah, these three dimensions are very important, and that's how also when we refer to the rate of dollarization, maybe in these discussions later on, this refers to the share of foreign currency loans and deposits this is also what most countries actually use when they measure dollarization or when they talk about this process.
Yeah, I've personally had issues with landlords where I refused to pay in dollars, citing laws, and they did not want to rent to me because they preferred it in dollars. And this was a constant tension with everyone in Georgia. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's outlawed, but they still do it. And everybody just assumes.
Yes. Yes, I can imagine. And I mean, it is an issue because we know that most of the population in Georgia, they earn their money in national currency, which is lari. So the earnings of most of the people, it's in lari. But then we're somehow forced to pay for the rent or also, what is also very interesting, it's not only about rents, but for example, also if one wants to buy a car, let's say, or if you go to a private tutor, private teacher, then also these kind of prices are set in dollar. And even though it is outlawed by now since a couple of years, especially, I mean, if one wants to buy a property, then you have to make this transaction in lari. But most of the construction companies have kind of found a way around this law, and they do announce prices in lari, but then you would see at the end of the announcement or in your contract a very important sentence, usually written in small letters, which says that this price may change on the day of the payment according to the lari US dollar exchange rate. So you basically steal the price of the property is still fixed to the US dollar. And then the other thing why it's so problematic. So one thing, it's because you have this mismatch between earnings and payments. So you earn money in lari and you have to pay in dollar. And the other thing is that you start to think in dollars. So this psychological moment should not be underrated because, if you're making plans, if you're thinking about, planning your life, paying your rent or buying an apartment or buying a car or whatever, then you start to think in dollars and not in lari. And that issue is also one of the hardest to overcome.
Just to sort of set up this context of why this happened, maybe you can give us a brief overview of what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Yes, that's a very good question to start out. And that was actually one of the things when I started to work on this research project, and I was reading a bunch of articles and books on dollarization in different countries. I realized also that in the general debate on dollarization, there was kind of this gap of understanding the history and the root of this phenomena. But for me, working on dollarization in Georgia, this was one of the first questions that I asked to myself, okay, where did this start and how did it start? And this is actually also what the first part of the book talks about, because also to give an idea about the structure of the book, it's divided into three parts. And the first part, it deals with the genesis of dollarization. So starting from the independence of 91 to the revolution of 2003. And in this first part of the book, I try to explain why foreign currency, which was in our case, first it was actually Russian ruble and then the US dollar, why it became so dominant in Georgia, and what were the kind of the domestic but also regional and global factors that contributed to that. And it's a very complex thing, but I will try to break it down to the key factors that that pushed or that made also dollarization inevitable in Georgia. That's what I argue. Well, so first of all, we need to know that until 1995, Georgia did not have its own national currency because of different political and also economic issues that were going on in the beginning of the 90s in Georgia. It really took some time until the national currency was issued in 1995. So until then, we have the several years where there is no national currency. But first of all, I mean, Georgia was in the very beginning still part of the ruble zone. So, and in the very beginning, there was also Soviet ruble in circulation until the hyperinflation started in at the end of 92. And then it became worse in 93 and 94. Then what's interesting is that alongside with ruble, the US dollar was already starting to play an important role. And it's also very interesting to observe that if later on also when there was no Soviet ruble, but the Russian ruble, that people were using ruble more for small transactions, let's say, but for bigger transactions and savings, whoever was in the position to save money in the beginning of the 90s, that's also another aspect, they would rather prefer to use US dollars. So there was a brief period when ruble and US dollar were kind of competing against each other, we could say that. But what I argue in the book, also talking about this hyperinflation in 93, 94, this was also the period when Russia also kind of finally lost its positions, because it had a chance to make the ruble, so to say, a regional currency among post-Soviet countries, but this chance was lost. And then the US dollar had it easier, so to say, to strengthen its positions in Georgia. And then even though in 95, Lari was introduced, and actually Lari was pretty pretty good and stable currency in the beginning until the crisis of 98. US dollar was still very important. Besides that, there are a whole range of political and economic factors that contributed to the weak currency, that, for example, the currency issues never really had priority also on the political agenda in this period. And also due to the whole range of liberalizations that were introduced very early in the early 90s in Georgia. So let's say, the liberalization of current account, of exchange rate, and so on and so forth, and also opening kind of the doors of the economy to foreign goods, removing all these import-export taxes. I mean, everything played into this, that basically you have a country with a destroyed economy in the 90s. And then before, instead of giving it a time to kind of build up, and also instead of giving the national currency a time to become a strong currency, you open up the doors for a competition. And it's a competition not only among different goods and services, but also currencies. So then it becomes clear which currency is kind of going to become the winner in such an unfair competition. So if you give the firms and also the population the freedom to choose which currency they want, then it kind of becomes obvious that even the newly introduced lari didn't really have much chances in Georgia.
Your book is called The Persistence of Dollarization. And in the book, there's a lot in which you go into about how not only domestic policy, but the fact that the Georgian post-Soviet state was in such a weak position that it was forced to develop dependencies on international financial institutions. And this interaction actually created policies domestically that undermined Georgian economic strength in the medium to long term. And so I'm wondering if you could just maybe outline how that relationship between a sort of weak and deindustrializing collapsed economy in the 90s, in the lead up to the Rose Revolution, for example, in this interaction with international financial institutions undermined Georgian economic sovereignty and strength.
Yes, thanks for bringing up the role and the importance of international organizations, because we really cannot talk about the issue of dollarization in any period of independent Georgia without discussing these very powerful organizations and two most important organizations that I'm also discussing in the book. This is the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and the first one out of these two has played obviously more important role, not only in regards to dollarization, but also if we talk generally about the development of the Georgian economy and even more broadly Georgian state. So even if we stick to the 90s and this first period in the history of dollarization, so until the Rose Revolution, what I call the genesis of dollarization, even here we can clearly see how directly basically dollarization was embedded in and within the transition policies that were suggested to Georgia. And I mean, the driving forces behind these transition policies, starting from the shock therapy to the other whole set of liberalization policies, which I previously mentioned, the key author, so to say, of these policies, it was obviously the International Monetary Fund. And this starts basically at the end of 1994, because, I mean, until 1994, it was not really decided if the IMF would get directly involved into Georgian economy and policies. But also, this is so interesting. And I have, even after I wrote this book, I continue to work on this period of early 90s, and especially the period of hyperinflation. And for me, it was a bit surprising, but also a very important finding that this very hyperinflation of 93-94, it had such an important role in kind of deciding the fate of the Georgian economy and the future economic policies. And this trajectory of liberal and later neoliberal economic policies has not changed even until now. And it was exactly in this very difficult period of hyperinflation that all the discussions that were going on beforehand in the country, so which way the economy should go to, which trajectory it should follow, they were kind of stopped and killed. And it was decided, we cannot get out of this without the help of the IMF. And the IMF did get involved. And this is when, at the end of 94, the macroeconomic structural adjustment program of the IMF started in the country. And since then, the International Monetary Fund has played an immense role in designing Georgian economic policies, which are also not really separatable from politics what we could call the other kind of policies. And in specific, in regards to dollarization, it was very interesting to see that already by the end of 1990s, when the level of dollarization in Georgia was getting really high, up to 80%, the IMF was already indicating in its reports how dollarization was becoming an important issue in the country. But on the same time, it was trying to make the Georgian government responsible for it, not taking into consideration all the other structural factors, which I mentioned, all these transition policies, the early liberalization of exchange rate, or the early trade liberalization and liberalization of current account and all this. So the whole blame was kind of on towards the Georgian government, I mean, which is not really fair. This kind of context, it really played a significant role in the process why dollarization in the first place came into being. This is why I argue it was inevitable in the 90s, because if you have a destroyed economy, you don't have a national currency, but you have like this open door policy and no one is really taking care of what's happening inside the country, then it's inevitable that a foreign currency takes over functions of the national currency. And the IMF, along with other international organizations, they were for sure not calling for de-dollarization measures at this period. It starts a bit later, after 2010, that then they kind of call for the government and the National Bank of Georgia to do something against dollarization, but that was then a bit too late.
Can you also talk about the financialization of Georgia as well? Because it goes into what's also currently we've witnessed struggles over evictions, and so maybe have a larger overview of financialization and where does dollarization fit into this?
Yes, a very important issue as well. But before we move to specifically to financialization, maybe a few words on this aspect of persistence, because and that's what also Brian asked. Now it crossed my mind that we have to dwell a bit more on that, because that's and then financialization is part of it. I mean, financialization is basically one of the explanations along with the role of international organizations. So why dollarization basically persisted for such a long time? Well, persistence is a very important theme in the book, and it is in a way a key theme. And this is kind of the second part of the book, because the second part of the book then deals with the post Rose Revolution reforms and state and this agenda of trying to build a new state, so the ambitions that that Saakashvili's government had, and all these economic reforms and promises to transform not only the state but the economy as well, to modernize everything and so on and so forth. And if we believe to very dominant explanations of dollarization that exist in the academic debate, when you have an economy which manages to reach a certain degree of macroeconomic stability, the inflation is also not high, then the rate of dollarization should also naturally decrease. So this is kind of a very widespread assumption in the dollarization debate. But the empirical cases of different countries show that this doesn't happen. So once you have high level of dollarization, even after certain macroeconomic stability, it's not so easy to get rid of it, so to say it in other words. And this is exactly also what we see in Georgia. And this is why I also ask this question in the book. So how can we explain it? So how can we explain that you have economic growth, you have macroeconomic stability, you have low inflation, but you still have dollarization? And this is also what authors have called dollarization hysteresis, because there are not really plausible explanations for this phenomena. And this was one of the key tasks or one of the key challenges I kind of took up for my research and tried to answer it. And then the way I approached it, and this is also where then financialization comes in, my point was to see and to analyze what kind of state emerged also after the Rose Revolution and what kind of economic accumulation regime, because without understanding this broader political economic picture and the context, we're also, I mean, we cannot only be looking at the domestic actors, but of course we have to take into consideration the global actors like the IMF, like the World Bank, all the foreign investors and so foreign capital, of course. It's really hard to solve this puzzle. So what the kind of the second part of the book tries to do is to grasp the idea of this post-Rose Revolution state, as well as the accumulation regime, which then delivers answers to the question why dollarization persisted. And if we want to focus now on the part of financialization, then we have to speak a bit more on the accumulation regime, or the kind of the economic the way of production in a way that emerges after the Rose Revolution. Because I mean, the stories one has probably read about Georgian economy are the stories of a miracle, how the economy grew after the Rose Revolution, and how kind of everything improved, even though at the same time we know that this economic miracle was not really translated into increase of welfare of most of the population in the country. So basically what happens after the Rose Revolution is that the general logic of having these liberal economic policies and liberalizing, deregulating, this does not really change. So what starts in the 90s transition policies, it kind of continues after the Rose Revolution. But one of the key changes that happens here is that if foreign capital was really hesitant to moved to Georgia because of a lot of legal and political issues. I mean, it was quite a headache for a foreign investor to invest money in the 90s Georgia. After the Rose Revolution, this changes. I mean, the government really puts a lot of effort in creating all kind of legal and political preconditions for foreign capital to come to Georgia. And the economic model or the economic development model that emerges is basically based on FDI, on foreign direct investments, and also on the assumption that the foreign direct investment will flow to Georgia and it's not going to stop. And for some time, this was actually working pretty well. I mean, alongside with this was accompanied with privatization and also formalization of the economy to a certain degree, which also contributed to this economic growth. But the inflow of FDI, this was really the key. And there is, of course, nothing wrong with the inflow of FDI as such, but it is very important how this happens, on what terms, and to which sectors this capital is diverted to. And what we see in Georgia's case, interestingly, also a large share of foreign direct investment was moving towards financial sector, which led to the growth of the, especially the banking sector, because commercial banks are the key pillars of the Georgian financial sector. So we see the inflow of foreign capital into the banking sector, and not just the simple inflow of this capital, but again, here comes now the IMF in 2006. Upon the recommendation of the IMF, there was a legal change in 2006, which allowed that from now on, the foreign investors were allowed to own shares in Georgian banks, in Georgian commercial banks, without any ceiling or limitations. And that led to foreign ownership of Georgian banks. I mean, the shareholder value, more than 50% of shares in Georgian banks, they were in foreign ownership. So we have on the one hand the financial sector, which is growing. I mean, it's very easy to trace this because if one looks at the assets of banks and compares it to GDP or whatsoever, and then if we look also at the loans they are giving and so on, this is all increasing tremendously after the Rose Revolution. This is also when the credit boom starts and all of this. And also later on, we see the inflow of FDI, especially after the 2008 crisis, somehow to the real estate sector. And so we have kind of the two important sectors of the economy, which is growing, the financial sector and the real estate sector, which are intertwined. And both were very important for dollarization. Because if you have this is also where exactly the financialization of accumulation regime comes in. So you have on the one hand, foreign-owned banks that are very keen on issuing, accepting deposits, first of all, in foreign currency, but also issuing loans in foreign currency, and especially dollar. And there was no legal limitation or no regulation to somehow have this under control. And this is why we ended up with more than half of household loans denominated in dollar by 2015. And on the other hand, we have real estate sector and then construction sector, which are also the winners of post-Rose Revolution accumulation regime, where you have prices set in dollars. So kind of also fitting in into this dollarization persistence. And as long as loan dollarization and deposit dollarization is increasing and price dollarization is there, and neither the government nor the central bank is really doing anything proactively or against this trend of dollarization, but quite the opposite, even anchoring it in the constitution that you have the freedom of exchange of currencies, and you create all kind of favorable conditions for foreign capital, including all these freedoms connected to usage of foreign currency, then it is in a way no wonder that that the level of dollarization did not decrease significantly. It stayed at about the rate of 70%, so in this post-revolution period.
So yeah, can you tell us what would be a more healthy rate of dollarization? Because like 78% seems crazy, but what would be like a sustainable level that you think as an economist that you would say?
Yeah, I mean, there are different ideas on that, but usually one would say, so something which is around 20% or at most 30, this could be more tolerable, but everything that is higher than 50%, especially. And I mean, also, we shouldn't forget that when I also mentioned these rates and this percentage, it is what's officially calculated, right? So the central bank basically takes the deposits and loans that are officially available. But I mean, we know that more than half of the Georgian economy is still informal, right? And then this also goes to, if it comes to especially loans, taking loans from private moneylenders and so on and so forth. I mean, this might not be the case anymore, but earlier when people didn't really trust banks that much, they would not also save money in banks necessarily, but at home or somewhere else. And it would also be in dollar, which, I mean, and all this is not really calculated when we refer to this rate. So we have to assume that this rate is actually higher and was also even higher than what we know now in the previous years.
On this topic of persistence, another theme in your book is way that especially after the Rose Revolution, a neoliberal authoritarian regime emerged that was the political backdrop of this FDI accumulation regime that you just mentioned. And I wanted you to explain the role of neoliberal ideology in the persistence of dollarization and the particular form of financialization that emerged in Georgia after the Rose Revolution.
Great that you ask this, because this was also exactly the aim of the book, and I have not mentioned it earlier, but maybe I should say now that the kind of the broad methodological frame that the book is based on, it's the political economy state theory, and it was the intention from the beginning on to, so not to look at this issue of dollar, even though it is a financial phenomenon, no doubt about that, and it is an economic phenomena, but my idea was not to reduce this very complex phenomena to only something financial, economic, technical, and so on, or even to central bank policies, because I realized in the beginning, already in the beginning, that it's much broader than this. I mean, it's in the first place, it's very political, it's also very much cultural. This is why I also decided to approach its analysis from a political economy state theory. And this is exactly, this leads me to answer your question, what role neoliberalism played here. And if we look at the kind of the state that emerges after the Rose Revolution, and if we try to analyze the intentions of the government, of the central bank, of the role that the civil society played also in this process of state building, then we do have some additional answers to dollarization persistence. So beyond all this accumulation regime and so on that I discussed previously. So it is very interesting that the that Saakashvili's government, after the Rose Revolution, I mean, they had this intention, and they were saying it loud as well, to create a minimalist state, which goes, of course, I mean, in line with the neoliberal state, so a minimal state with as little bureaucracy and administrative capacity as possible. Also, what is very important when the government has the intention to create a minimum state, it also actually tells its citizens, we are also getting rid of all these social responsibilities that the state can have. So do not expect from us to take care of your welfare in a way. So that's kind of a indirect or direct message, I would say, to the population. And on the other hand, what is very interesting is that especially in the ideas and economic policies and policies towards the central bank, what we see right after the Rose Revolution, we see also a lot of libertarian ideas. So, for example, there was even an idea to abolish a central bank, which is which might sound kind of unbelievable, but it was debated and it was discussed. So it was not only a minimal state which tries to cut off bureaucracy. I mean, the official argumentation there was also very interesting, and it sounded very legitimate that they wanted to outroot corruption that way. So the government kind of saw this, we shut down now all the regulatory agencies in order to fight against corruption. So we don't try to make them healthier, these institutions, we just abolished them. So this was kind of the one of the main mottos, and then at the same time, even coming up with this idea to shut down the central bank. I mean, this is already very telling, and even later on, I mean, even though the central bank was not abolished due to different reasons, and also partly to reasons which we do not 100% know why. Even later on, I mean, continuously we see, so starting from the Rose Revolution, the whole period that this government was in power, we see the attempts of the government to attack the central bank, to weaken the central bank, to remove, they tried a couple of times also to remove the observatory function from the central bank, so which is basically oversees the financial sector, what the banks are doing, microfinancial institutions are doing, and so on and so forth, which is a very important function of the central bank. So we see this conflict, a constant conflict going on between the government and between the central bank, which is a conflict, of course, around the power. So who controls the money and credit policy, and who controls the monetary policy? And even as late as 2009, there were also ideas circulating to abolish the national currency. So this fits also very well into this hierarchy and also libertarian understanding of not only monetary policy, but also the understanding of currency. Because Hayek, for example, he wrote a book on denationalization of money, where he was arguing that it would actually be a better solution to have private issuers of money, so that basically private entities can issue currencies and then let them compete against each other. And then whichever currency turns out to be more desired than wanted, that's the currency which makes it through the competition, so to say. So abolishing national currency, and the idea, I mean, coming in the government circles, right? Not from some opposition parties or civil society organizations, but the government itself. This already also tells how the government, in a way, approached the importance of national currency, the importance of central bank, and having sovereignty of conducting money and credit policy all over. So this is very important, and this is what this is what helps us, I think, also to understand why not only that dollarization was given additional encouragement to persist through all this deregulation of finance, allowing the foreign ownership of banks, allowing the issue of loans and foreign currency, then having this booming real estate sector, which sets prices in dollars, but also not doing anything for active de-dollarization.
With a 70% formal dollarization, we have in effect got rid of our national currency.
Yeah, one could say so.
The only people that get paid in Georgian lari are poor workers, you know, who are constantly facing inflation.
Yes.
And they're, and it's like a lot of our struggles in the union have been over the devaluation of their wages. They're not even asking for increase in wages, but indexation. Mm-hmm. And usually our victories are not even full indexation. Like we 10 years ago, say like they're about 50% say devaluation of their wages, and through our victory we may only win 40%. So in effect they're actually getting less money now than they were 10 years ago.
Yes.
And that's almost all goes around that.
Yeah, I think that that's also a very good it's a very good and very important way of looking at the implications of dollarization, because and this is also what's missing quite many times when dollarization is discussed, that if you have a high level of dollarization in the country, it doesn't mean that it has similar impacts on basically everyone in the country, right? Because you have, like, especially, I mean, let's look at Georgia, right? If we have certain sectors where, people are paid in US dollar or people are paid in euros, let's say. I think it's also very common among certain civil societal organizations or in the segments where people would earn more than average. And for them, of course, I mean, they are way less prone to any currency risks or any currency devaluation risks. And the strong national currency does not have the same importance as for the most of the population that earns money in the national currency and who are maybe then even indebted in foreign currency and have to serve their loans in a different currency. So yeah, it definitely has very different implications for these different groups in the society.
What would be the distinguishing differences, let's say? What distinguishes Sakafu period from the Dream period? Curious to know how you would differentiate these two different governments.
Yeah, very important. And then we are actually approaching the third part of the book, having in mind this also kind of the basic structure of the book. That is since the book is also structured in a way chronologically, that's the third part of the book, which discusses how dollarization evolved and was unfolded in a way after 2012, so after the government change. And what is interesting, I will start, I think, with the second part of your question and then come to dollarization, because if we want to have a broader context and a broader political economic picture in mind first, I argue in the book and also elsewhere that in terms of neoliberal policies or in terms of the view of development and economic development and also the accumulation regime itself, nothing really changes fundamentally after 2012. I mean, the Georgian Dream government basically continues the path, the previous path, where FDI is still very important. And I mean, even if we look at the economic sectors that are the drivers or that are the engines of economic growth in Georgia until today, it's the same. I mean, you still have the financial sector, real estate and construction sectors and tourism that are booming and that are the key sectors contributing to the economic growth. So we cannot really say that there was a in a way a structural change in an economic structure, or there was any significant change in the composition of GDP, or we cannot also argue that something really fundamentally changed in the export goods that Georgia exports, that, you know, now we can produce I don't know, let's say computers, and we're exporting. No, I mean, it's the same agricultural goods and also the raw materials that Georgia is exporting. So, I mean, in terms of looking at how economy structures and what are its driving forces and the logic, it has not changed. And also the understanding of development, economic development, the state, it also didn't change. And then if it comes down to authoritarianism, I mean, if I argued in the book that after the Rose Revolution, we really faced something which is framed as authoritarian neoliberalism, I mean, it's also hard to say that something changed in a better direction in terms of authoritarianism, maybe even worse. So I don't see any fundamental structural changes in the overall political economic context. But interestingly, things did change in terms of dollarization. But it was not, again, I mean, I will come back to this, but this change was not due to the new government, who had different views and perceptions, but I think it was more the, kind of how different things came together, and I will explain this. So what is interesting and what was also puzzling for me when I started working on this research was that, so I realized Georgia has been facing this very high level of dollarization basically since independence of 91, but this issue was somehow never really politicized and never problematized. So even though, so it was there, everyone knew about it, but neither in the 90s nor after the Rose Revolution, and also it would not have happened after 2012 if different things had not happened, it was not on the political agenda. So one thing is that the government did not really problematize and prioritize it. The central bank did not do it either. But also, I mean, if we look at the whole narratives, arguments, themes in what opposition parties would argue about or how they would oppose the government, or if we look at different civil societal actors, be it NGOs or people from academia or activists, this topic of dollarization, it somehow never pops up, which was a huge puzzle for me. And then something happened in 2015 that kind of triggered this process, but it was a trigger. So in 2015, we had what was later called Lari crisis. It actually started at the end of 2014, and then it evolved in 2015 and 16, where Lari started to depreciate to US dollar. And within quite short time in 2015, it lost almost 50% of its value to US dollar. And then a whole range of issues and risks that were actually connected to dollarization became visible. And it became visible in the first place to the households who were indebted in dollar. And as I mentioned, I mean, by 2015, more than half of retail loans, so the household loans, they were denominated in US dollar, even though these people, I mean, most of them, 90% of them, they were earning money in Georgian lari. And by this time also, I mean, corporate and SME debt, 70% of this debt was in dollar. But again, I mean, as always, it always hurts most for the households because they are not, they are the ones who have to bear all the risks, because the bank or the microfinance organization or whoever the lender is in this case, they don't carry the currency risk. So it's the borrower himself or herself that has to deal with it. So even though Lari was depreciated, the wages remained the same, these people had to serve their loans in dollar, which was, I mean, so that they basically had much more debt. And this is when, and I mean, also we have to, again, so one thing is this, lari depreciation and people all of a sudden realizing they are in a really huge financial trouble. And the, on the other hand, again, the bigger context is that a lot of people are indebted by that time because this credit boom that started in 2005, and I mean, this debt was accumulated, right? And already in 2008 and 2009 with the financial crisis and then the war with Russia and Georgia, the financial situation of a lot of borrowers was quite deteriorated. And at the same time, as I mentioned, the post-Rose Revolution accumulation regime did lead to economic growth, but in terms of poverty reduction, unemployment reduction, reduction of income inequality, it didn't have positive results. So you have even increasing poverty levels and people really struggling to repay their debt. So even if the lari crisis had not happened, you have this accumulation of whole range of socioeconomic issues, which were also a direct result of that accumulation regime that evolved after the Rose Revolution. And on top of that comes the depreciation of lari and a lot of people indebted in dollar. And this is also the time when, maybe a bit ironically, but it was the IMF that started to problematize this issue as one of the first ones, or at least in its reports, you can read it, that they are calling on for the Georgian Central Bank to do something about this increasing foreign currency debt. And it was also the IMF that reported in 2015 that Georgia was facing the issue of over-indebtedness. I mean, over-indebtedness, this means when people pay too much money for serving their loans, and then they are left with very little resources to cover their expenses. So by 2015, if you want to have the more exact numbers, 1/3 of household borrowers, they were spending more than half of their income to serve their loans. So even if they were managing to serve their loans, it didn't mean that the problem was solved, because they had then very little money to tackle all the other expenses. So it is this, to kind of sum this up. So it is on the one hand, the accumulation of debt, not improving, but even worsening rates of poverty, unemployment, income inequality, starting from early 2000s, that's accumulated in the population, the issue of over indebtedness and high level of foreign currency debt among households that is then hit by this currency crisis in 2015. And then all of a sudden, genius kind of out of the bottle, and dollarization is out there. So then everyone had to talk about it, and this is exactly when, for the first time since the 90s, the issue of dollarization was finally problematized. And again, I mean, here the role of the IMF and the World Bank is very interesting in a way, because they were the ones kind of pushing the central bank and the government to do something about it. And this was then followed by certain de-dollarization measures, but we could discuss that separately.
And that's where we also get the pension, right? As a way to have savings in the country.
Yes, the pension reform and also the capital market reform, which was started. These two reforms, they were also suggested by the international organizations, and they were seen as a kind of as a solution or as a way to create resources in lari, in national currency, long-term money resources, so to kind of accumulate money in lari and to have this financial resource available in national currency.
So there's a huge drive towards immigration because of loans. So how does that, maybe you can speak more about that. How does the dollarization and then having all these loans, devaluation goes into also losing homes, or needing to pay off these mortgages or personal loans. And also in our research of asking nurses, it's like over 98% said they need to take out a loan because their wages were not enough to cover basic costs.
Yes, immigration and remittances. That's one of the key points. And because obviously, I mean, if we look at this topic of immigration, and if we look at remittances which are sent to Georgia yearly, annually, it plays an immense role in stabilizing the Georgian economy, and it plays an immense role in, yeah, in basically saving thousands and thousands of families from poverty. So because it's becoming even more and more difficult in the last few years for a lot of Georgians to find a properly paid job in Georgia. So the number of immigrants is increasing again after COVID restrictions have been removed to travel. And in terms of dollarization, I mean, of course, if you have the inflow, not only, I mean, of foreign direct investments and foreign capital, but also the remittances which are transferred, well, mostly in US dollar, but also in euros, this means that there is also an additional important source of foreign currency that flows into the country. And I argue in my book that this factor, that these remittances were transferred in euro and USD, and also, so not only people earning money in or getting salary in foreign currency in the country, but also others who had access to dollars or to euros through remittances, that also kind of encourage the persistence of this process, because you have then wider amount of people, a larger amount of people who have access to dollars, let's say, and then it becomes easier to kind of accept the status quo, that the dollar is so important because you also have access to it. But as for the second aspect of your question, so this dependence on loans, and then it becomes even worse if it's a loan in a foreign currency, in dollar, for example. I mean, this is a huge issue, because when we talk about this credit boom, which started in 2004, 2005 in Georgia, and then since then, I mean, if we look at the volume of these loans, either in absolute numbers or also in relation to GDP, it's increasing steadily. We have to say that in many cases, people were and are still, they have to take these loans, and especially the consumer loans, for example, either because they have severe health issues, or their family members have health issues and they somehow have to deal with that, or during Rose Revolution government, one of the common reasons was also to take a loan to help the family members to get them out of prison because of the zero tolerance policy. I mean, this was a very common issue. Or also, I mean, a lot of consumer loans were taken and are still taken to also really tackle the daily needs and cover the basic needs, because even for those who work and have monthly salary, this money is simply not enough to cover the daily costs. So, I mean, this is it is a very serious challenge for the whole economy, not only for the borrowers, but the whole economy. And I mean, we already saw this actually, because I don't know if you remember, but in 2018, there was this moment when the prime minister back then, Rakhtadze, he stated in his speech that more than 600,000 of people in Georgia were kind of blacklisted, because, I mean, they were basically insolvent. They could not repay their loans anymore. I think it was even 630,000 people. quite insane. And then later on, I mean, eventually Charity Fund even bought these loans, because at this point the government also realized that if you have this amount of indebted people who cannot repay their loans, it's not their problem. It's not only their problem anymore, but it's the problem for the whole economy. And it's a political problem too. So you have there your this entanglement of individual and collective problem, as well as economic and political problem, becoming inseparable in that case.
Thought it was really interesting how you talk about, on the one hand, for example, the neoliberal regime of Saakashvili obviously is guided by libertarianism, so it makes sense. But then on the other hand, you also have the NGO-led civil society, which is only focused on the idea of democratization. And it was really interesting how, like, the government and the civil society work in this like symbiosis to exclude political discussions about the economy. And then they, in this nation building process of trying to say that neoliberalism and markets are a part of what it means to be Georgian and Georgian national state building, that the universities and other places of like intellectual reproduction also don't include these socioeconomic discussions. I think it's very clear today that that's still the case largely. So how does this dynamic and process play into not only the persistence of dollarization, but also the larger limiting of the political imagination of how to actually solve the socioeconomic problems that Georgia faces today?
Yes, thanks for asking this, because it's so crucial. And luckily, things have changed to a certain extent by now. I mean, if we compare this to the situation even 10 years ago, let's say. But yes, I mean, this was for me also in the process of research, it was very interesting to realize that starting from the 90s, especially, and then basically until recently, this was definitely the case that domestic socioeconomic issues, and there were plenty of them throughout Georgia's history, did not really make it to the political agenda. And I mean, with this, I don't mean only the party agenda or the government political agenda, but also, as you said, what surprised me more to realize that even the civil society sector, I mean, what we mean, right, with the traditional understanding of civil society in Georgia, so basically the NGOs, the church, the university or the academia in a broader sense, different activist groups and so on and so forth, the media, of course, very importantly, they have not been, they also have not been very sensitive to different social and economic issues. And I mean, we can name maybe, it's not only about dollarization, of course. I mean, it's about the right of workers. It's about the socio-ecological costs of different economic projects. It's about workplace security, and I mean all this kind of. We have a lot of issues in Georgia, which is also embedded in the legislation, and I mean this would take us to another broader discussion. But overall, it is really remarkable that also these traditional civil societal actors, especially in the 90s, but also after the Rose Revolution, they didn't really pay attention so much to this kind of issue. So but then if one asks, what were then the other important issues that were more important? I mean, historically, these were the issues of democratization, pluralism, human rights, but also very specific understanding of human rights, where you would not talk about social rights, and also a very specific understanding of democracy that also is very important. And I'm not saying that these issues are not important, and I don't mean it that these issues should not have been tackled, but what was, and it still is in a way, surprising to me that other kind of issues, or let's name it, right, poverty, income inequality, why didn't we hear about it all the time on TV, on radio, at universities? I mean, these were the burning issues back then and are, still are by now. And I think one of the explanations for that was definitely also, I mean, we have to find the, or we have to look for the roots of this issue in the very transition policies that were started in the 90s. So this so-called transition agenda that not only Georgia, but different post-Soviet countries went through, and that the kind of discourses and the kind of narratives that were coming from different international organizations or donor organizations that were very important for the survival of civil societal organizations. I mean, the priorities for them was laid more on the side of party pluralism, transparency, democracy, but not really so much on the local socioeconomic issues. So I think that that's one of the explanations. And then looking at this picture, it became also for me more understandable why the issue of dollarization, why the issue of weak national currency was not problematized within the civil societal actors. And yeah, I mean, the situation has changed. It has changed a little after, especially after 2012, because, I mean, now we do have at least some civil societal organizations, some NGOs, we do have social movements and also activists or alternative trade unions who have successfully tried to politicize many of these issues I named. I mean, it doesn't mean that they are part of the dominant political or societal discourse in the country yet, but I think things are on their way, more and more people and more groups are talking about. I mean, political parties still don't, we have to say this, political parties still do not really try to, I mean, it's very surprising, actually. They do not really try to tackle these issues. I mean, still the old stories, the older folk is more important for their political agenda. But on the other side, I mean, again, what we would traditionally call civil society groups, they have become more active to bring these topics also to the media, to different discussions and so on. And then last but not least, we shouldn't forget that also what we have seen in the last few years in Georgia, there has been also growing grassroots movements and grassroots groups that have then grown bigger that have managed to resist in a way the ongoing economic, the reproduction of the economic development idea projects, and to show that the way the government perceives development and then the way the government tries to implement its economic policy, that this is not right and this cannot be going on.
And my last question is pretty much in a similar vein. It's like the individualization of most problems. It's interesting because a lot of the civil and political rights are continuously on air. We realize, you know, being gay is not a personal problem. You know, being a woman who is sexually harassed, not a personal problem. These are problems for the public. Some things we have to solve in a, you know, in a legal way, in a ways how we structure our society. Yet when it comes to everything economic, poverty, everything is it's your problem, it's your fault, you can't pay your loans, you're going to lose a home. So, and we know why this happens. Like you said, the money's not really coming in for these things. If we do have anyone who speaks against these things, are pretty much doing it on their own funds or some found some way to forge out a space for themselves. And I did, like, I was in the regions once, and I was asking the women, had like three different pieces of paper, and I was like, okay, write what you, all your problems, like things that you hear every day, your friends, your neighbors, and they wrote all of those problems. So I was like, the second paper, I was like, write all the things you hear on TV, and they wrote those. And then third was like, and then what do the NGOs talk about? And it was like none of those three things matched. It was like kind of amazing. Sometimes there was some overlap between like certain things, like, you know, like disability rights they heard on TV from an NGO initiative, you know. But the problems that they talked about, none of those things were showing up in either TV or NGOs. And that's the reality of it. And then people seem to have a hard time realizing that people have a natural dislike for a lot of these civil society, you know, because it's their problems are not being articulated. And most of the time, these people aren't going to form new movements. They're just leaving the country, or they're trying to deal with the problems themselves. So there's no alternative that they're articulating themselves when they don't see themselves, because there's no resources for that. And they're all about trying to survive, you know? So I think that what you said was exactly correct in that sense.
Yes, I definitely agree with you, Sopo. And I think you brought also a great example of this. And I think we do have a very clear explanation of this individualization of problems. I think that's how you framed it. And I would agree with this, because this is what neoliberalism has been teaching us, that if you are good enough, if you are strong enough, if you are clever enough, if you can compete against others, then you make it and you have good life. And then if you don't make it, then you are the one who is to blame for it. And you are the one who is to blame for your own poverty, and so on and so forth. I mean, that's part of it, right? And unfortunately, I mean, this is based on my personal observations, not on research, but since I live in this country and I have a family here and know quite some people, based on my personal observations, quite some people have also started to believe in this, that if something is going wrong in their life, that's their own fault, which is dangerous. But on the other hand, and on the other side, what I also observe is that there is also quite some solidarity, which is increasing. I mean, the very recent example is, again, this evictions, the forceful evictions of indebted people from their houses because they could not repay the loans or due to different reasons. And I think this very last and recent example showed us very well how civic activists and also some organizations, some NGOs, people from academia, I mean, different groups, they came together to protect these families from eviction, right? And I think we have seen some other examples like this, and it gives me personally hope. I don't want to end this also on a very pessimistic note, but it really also honestly gives me hope that as much as we are saying that the government and the political parties in general, and still most of the civil societal organizations, as much as they might be really far from the real concerns of daily concerns and struggles of people and of the population, there is also this solidarity, and there are also grassroots movements, and again also civil societal organizations recently that are trying to resist, at least to show some resistance. I mean, it's still hard because, I mean, we know the power distribution is still very unequal if we would take these two big groups on two sides and two poles, but at least to show certain resistance. It does give me a reason for a bit hope, but at the same time, I am well aware that this cannot be the way out, and it cannot also be the way towards any political or economic transformation. Rocai sarmat leu sinet da uprong tista za bus. Shemetzi se demokratia zroca sheni koveli sitwa pechem ze kidi akwela partia. Galaxina swin memo jiket heli ga interese drachte bak ara peri. Akiza duele bura dominire psnatris peri. Umodra obi sagan wela persda edon tueri. Galaxina swin memo jiket heli ga interese drachte bak ara peri. Akiza duele bura dominire psnatris peri. Umodra obi sagan wela persda edon tueri.